Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Welcome to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our anchor sponsor, Gateway Marketing Cafe. If, like me, you are not much of a shopper and you want to give a gift that works for everyone, I highly recommend the Gateway gift card. They're available seasonally and they're great stocking stuffers. They can be used not just at Gateway, but at Django, Centro, Zombie Burger, any other Des Moines business that's in the Orchestrate network. And for every $100 you spend on a gift card, you get an additional $20 free gift card. So if, hey, kids, my kids, if you're listening, yes, like last year, like every year, you're getting gift cards again this year. And folks, if you want them, pick them up at Gateway Market or any of the Orchestra Hospitality businesses and mention you heard about them from the Fallon Forum. Thanks also to one of our other sponsors, Central Iowa Realtor Joe Henry, with 23 years in the business. Joe is also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. Hey, quick shout out to the Des Moines Average Session for our bumper music, and I'd like to welcome Charles Goldman to the program. Charles, good to have you here.
Yeah, it's good to be here, Ed.
And before we go any further, we're going to be talking about some great research done about AI and its impact on the human brain. But first, as a way to kind of warm up to that conversation, I want to play this clip from one of my favorite movies. And maybe 20 years as well, Idiocracy.
If you have one bucket that holds 2 gallons and another bucket that holds 5 gallons, how many buckets do you have?
2?
Thank you.
I know people listening on radio or to the podcast can't see what transpires after.
Yeah, that would be better if we were streaming.
Yeah. After our hero guesses the correct number of buckets, he looks over to see other people who are taking the exam, and they're trying to stuff different size, different shaped blocks into the wrong holes. And one of them actually, he hides what he's doing. So he doesn't cheat. As he's trying to stuff it into the wrong hole. Anyway, oh gosh, it's a great movie.
It's so current.
Well, it's about life. It's about life in the U.S. in the year 2500, 2505, I think.
Right.
But yeah, it's so frighteningly current.
Yeah, we didn't have to wait that long to
get
there.
No, sadly, and AI is not helping.
No,
and there's been some great research done on this.
Well, it was interesting because the Guardian had a article titled "The Dawn of the Stupid Age," and
I can see how you'd like that title.
Well, it's interesting because the definition of stupidity is not what you would think in terms of what AI is doing to the human brain. I think most people would think literacy and stupidity involve lack of information, lack of knowledge in detail about
In addition to trying to stuff a square block into a round hole.
Well, and that's the whole point is that. If we're going to live with AI, before they, of course, turn Terminator and kill us all, especially in the notion, in the situation where AI can do the job of a human, and, of course, the people who are most risked now of losing jobs are not the blue-collar workers from automation.
Talk show
hosts. It's the the white-collar kind of worker, the professional class, which AI can potentially replace. So the question is, what would be unique about a human versus the AI in those settings? And what's this article is pointing out is that research was done, very, very straightforward. some using EEG monitoring. You know, that's where they put all the probes on your head and sort of which part of the brain is firing away. And then also other research was done with functional MRI, in which you're doing things all the subjects in the MRI. You can see which parts of the brain are metabolizing and active.
Yeah, and so some of the research was done by a scientist named Natalia Kosmina. I think I'm saying her name right, Kosmina.
I believe so.
And I just found it fascinating. I mean, she basically, she got volunteers, students at MIT, to be a part of this study.
Right, not exactly a subject group that's...
No, that's inclined. They're not the
general population.
Right, with the amount of tuition they pay, they're not inclined to be stupid. Or maybe they are, I don't know. But anyway, what she found was that when people started using these, what they call large language models like ChatGPT.
Right, or general AI. Yeah.
It actually started changing the brain. You know, the memories didn't seem as good. And, it's so clear that this is a problem.
Well, the key part of that research was, and other research has shown the same, is that the more analog you're forced to do, the analog environment in which you're forced to do the work, like to write a paper or something, mm-hmm. which would be no search engines, pen and paper,
right.
Go through books.
Right. The way we organize this talk show.
Right. You then move on to a group where they could use a search engine.
Right.
And then you move on to the group where they used AI.
Okay, we use search engines here.
Right. I mean, most people
would. And we read articles.
But the point was that as you moved along that continuum, the brain activity in the places that were most important toward creating memory to...
Remembering
what you wrote.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Not just, but also to learn how to synthesize, to take disparate facts and try to make something coherent out of it. That basically there was almost no activity in those brain regions when using AI.
Mm-hmm.
Versus analog, of course, was very brain intensive. It's the same thing you see with what's happened to reading in general.
Yeah.
And this is not just because we're a bunch of old guys. And we're saying, we used to have blue book tests and essay tests and we read books. Elite school students, if you would query them, the vast majority of them will tell you they have never read a book in its entirety.
Right.
Right? They've read snippets supplied to them by the teacher. But, the point is that AI is debilitating the brain in exactly the regions that are necessary to learn how to synthesize thoughts.
Yeah.
So what AI is basically doing is it's substituting all of that function in your brain. That's why the brain doesn't have to turn on. The problem, of course, is you're not getting the skill. Because how do you create an argument? How do you take a position? How do you figure out whether something is a fake if you have no ability, to not be literal, to bring together thoughts? And that's the point. AI is not that much different from computers. Earlier computer iterations. They are highly literal. There are examples where, they'll give you like three numbers and they'll tell, and they'll say, what's the least number of numbers you could use? Or which numbers could you use to use only the least number of numbers, right? And oftentimes in a series of that they'll give, there's more than one correct answer. But the AI will only accept what it considers the correct answer, even though both answers are right.
Right, yeah.
And so it's a very literal enterprise. And it's somewhat devoid of creativity, even though it seems immensely
devoid of creativity, I would
say. Although in the music world, obviously, it isn't, because we have all these sort of AI artists now.
Yeah,
but that's not totally unexpected, because music has been manipulated to basically be auto-tuned and computer-generated.
And I don't call that music anymore.
No, I mean...
It's not.
Well, you're a musician.
I'm not. So there.
Right. And you're an analog musician. You actually touch an instrument to have it make sound.
Right.
And there's no other to it.
Hopefully it's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to read a paragraph from this Guardian story about this researcher. Quote, we know from our collective experience that once you become accustomed to the hyper-efficient cybersphere, the friction-filled real world feels harder to deal with, the analog world, as you called it. So you avoid phone calls, use self-checkouts, order everything from an app, you reach for your phone to do the math sums you used to be able to do in your head, you know, to check a fact, and you check a fact before you have to dredge it up from your memory. And to input your destination on Google Maps, you know, when you travel, you do that instead of thinking out where you're going. It's just, you go to autopilot.
Right.
And yeah, we're inclined to do what's easier, right? It's just we always want to take the easiest way.
Okay, but you're putting it forth as a moral judgment, and
yes,
it's what our brain is programmed to do.
Right, we're also programmed to eat all the sweets we can find.
Well, we can talk about that later. We're not programmed. We're seduced into it. But our brain requires an excessive amount of energy for a body of this size, okay, and a brain of this size. Now, I agree. We meet a lot of people who I don't think they're using that much energy. But so the brain is always going to say, if I can do this quickly and with the least effort, that's the way to go. And AI is offering the brain exactly that. The problem is twofold. One is you don't learn the skills to be able to do this without a computer.
Right. Yeah. Or to be able to navigate from point A to point B without
GPS.
Yeah.
Yeah. Instead, we did it much more safely looking at maps in the middle of the night as we were driving. So,
well, that's why you have a passenger with
well,
you.
Well, I understand that.
You don't have the map on your lap.
Well,
in
if
the
you're
dark.
Alone, it's got to be right in front of you. Yeah. You know, so I don't have the same feeling about GPS you're expressing. But the second problem is that people are going to college and they're told they have to write a paper. And their default is to go to ChatGPT or sure. Perplexity or whichever AI you like, Gemini, whatever. And generate the paper, they make a few edits, and they hand it in.
Cheat GPT, I'd call it.
But the thing is that the point of writing a paper in college is not the information in the paper. It's the process.
Right, exactly.
And if you don't train your brain into that process...
You'll never do
you
it.
You will never do it.
Yeah.
And that is the real danger of AI, which it's not allowing the process in your brain any longer.
But again, back to we are programmed. We are hardwired by our... I mean, again, I don't think we've changed that much since we used to live in trees and caves. And, you know, we always want to find the easiest.
You mean we didn't come down like this?
Sorry. Sorry to ruin your 4,000-year-old Earth theory. We always want to try to do things the easiest way. And you know what? Animals are like that as well. We try to be as efficient as possible. And again, I get back to what I said about sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Sugar is the best way to get calories really, really fast. And fortunately in nature, they're not that easy to come by. And the ones that you can get in fruits, say, don't come with a lot of additional nutritional baggage. But nowadays, you know, I mean, this is why the big food conglomerates put sugar and salt and fat and everything. It lures us into eating it. It's the easy way out. ChatGPT is like sugar, fat, and salt for the brain.
Well, it's a different chemistry of the brain that involves those things. But I think you also have to put it in the context of when you're paying the exorbitant amount of money that we pay for higher education in this country.
Yeah, ridiculous.
Then, and as our culture has changed, the notion of going to college, for instance, simply to learn something you want to learn, whether it's related to a vocational endpoint or not, that's a pretty expensive endeavor if you're simply going to do something just for that purpose. And you could do that before because, you know, if you had to do something more, it wasn't that expensive. But now, of course, it's $100,000 a year at some of the, the premier schools. And so you got to get something out of it. I mean, you have to have something coming out the other end.
Besides the good parties.
Right. But so the students look at it as, what do I care about the process? I can do this. I can get this done. I'll get a good grade, which obviously for professional schools is really all they care about. I mean, it's a continuation of high school now, right?
Yeah. Well, but you know, you're coming out of college with that experience is not going to prep you well for whatever work you think you're qualified for.
Well, interestingly, that's still true. 60-70% of people do not work in the field that's related to the college major.
That would be me.
The problem is that what that field could have given you if you weren't looking for the quickest way to do it using, you know, AI, you could have learned the process so that you could take that. That's the underpinnings of knowledge in many realms of activity. But instead, you learn neither the process nor the specific information for that vocation or, you know, or that profession. Yeah. You know, and I think that that's also part of why it's ChatGPT and others are the thing on college campus now. Yeah. I mean, you know, you have situations where professors are keeping students in the classroom to do that work so they can monitor what they're doing. And of course, there's a lot of programs out there to see whether it's been copied off of something off the internet or it has the mark of, you know, of chat of like, you know, Grok.
Yeah.
Yeah, which of course would be calling your teacher a Nazi. You know, I'm sorry. Actually not.
But that was quite an aside.
Well, because Grok had a racist iteration.
Oh.
What a surprise from somebody who grew up in apartheid South Africa.
You're talking about Elon Musk's.
Well, yeah, no, Grok is Tesla's AI.
Yeah. Yeah. So folks, I mean, fight back against this. Don't get sucked into using ChatGPT. Even though it may give you a good grade in school, your brain will begin to kind of shrink and become like the guy we heard from at the first part of the segment.
Well, if all you can do is what ChatGPT does, you're not value added in any way to a workplace.
Right.
You know,
if you in that case, the robots have already taken your job.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've already ceded it to them.
Yeah. So when you travel, next time you travel, don't use ChatGPT. Use a roadmap. Or your memory. Don't do it at night like Charles likes to do. Don't use the self checkout line, and don't use your phone when you want to think about doing a simple equation.
Well, you don't use the self checkout line for another reason, right?
Yes, because I want to make sure that there are people
who are still human beings. Yeah,
and because I usually like the checkout people at the places I go, I know them. Mm-hmm. I want to say hello to them.
Yeah,
I can't say hello to anybody at a self checkout line. Actually, the store that I frequent for groceries, that Kathy and I frequent, does not have a checkout line. Sorry, a self-check line.
Oh, I was going to say not. Checkout
line. Take whatever you want.
Take whatever you want.
Right, right, right.
leave whatever you want in the can up front.
All right. Well, enough of this. We've got to take a short break here. We're going to come back. Speaking of food, we're going to talk about SNAP and how SNAP and Medicaid, for that matter, even though they are important to the people who receive them, they've also become huge subsidies for a handful of the worst kind of big businesses. Back in a minute with you, Charles Goldman and myself, Ed Fallon, here on the Fallon Forum.
Thanks to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks again to our sponsors, including Catholic Peace Ministry. CPM promotes peaceful resolution to war and the need to end the permanent war economy. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com. Thanks also to Western Optometry. Dr. Joel Western and his staff are fluent in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. until 5 p.m., and also on Saturdays by appointment. That's Western Optometry. All right, Ed Fallon with you here, and Charles Goldman. So, Charles, an article came to your attention that interested both of us. It was in the Boston Globe. It was a story about Massachusetts recipients of SNAP benefits, and it found that 74% of working-age SNAP recipients in the Bay State are employed, and half of them are employed full-time.
All right.
So that kind of calls out the lie. These people should just get a job, you know?
Well, and you also have to include that there's another percentage, probably around 15% of SNAP benefits, who would not be able to work because they're either children or they're disabled.
Right.
So the reality with SNAP is about 10% of SNAP beneficiaries are potentially able to work and don't. And, you know, the reason that, of course, that the Republicans concentrate on that 10% and make it seem like it's the majority is it just goes back to Reagan and the welfare queen.
Well, and they go beyond. They talk about – what I hear mostly is they're harping against illegal immigrants using SNAP benefits. And that's even that's an even smaller component of the
class. That's correct. And that's not a – that's not a legal use of SNAP benefits.
Right, and
they don't have.
It's access. neither legal nor common. But I was interested to see in this story the where. So again, most people who are receiving SNAP work. Where do they work? Well, they work at places where they aren't getting a livable wage, so they have to rely on public assistance. So these corporations basically are having their low wages subsidized by the taxpayers.
Well, in two ways, it's subsidized by SNAP.
Right.
And then it's subsidized by Medicaid.
Yep.
Because they don't have to offer fulsome medical insurance, if they offer it at all, to these workers. And especially if they keep them part-time, they don't have to offer them.
Right, right. It was a few years ago that I think it was Walmart that on the – when you came in to apply for the job, it directed you on how to also apply for Medicaid. Because they basically conceding that they were not going to pay you a livable wage.
Right. Well, you know, it works both ways. But why don't you mention some of the people in Massachusetts who are have the most SNAP benefits?
Right. I don't know how many people were reviewed for this, but 2,500 of the SNAP beneficiaries in Massachusetts who are part of this analysis work for Amazon. Another 2,300 for Walmart. Mm-hmm. the other companies that had a significant number of employees who, again, weren't able to make a living, you know, a living wage while on SNAP. That includes Uber, DoorDash, and Tempest Unlimited. Tempest Unlimited, I guess that's a developmental disabilities provider. And each of those businesses had at least 1,400 workers who relied on food stamps, on SNAP mm-hmm. benefits.
Well, and then, you know, one of the big grocers up there, Stop and Shop, Mass Brigham, Harvard's Hospital.
Hmm.
Was up there, Dollar Tree, Albertsons, another grocery.
Dollar Tree, no surprise there.
Right. Well, Dollar Tree and Albertsons are a different model of a grocery.
Sure.
And then a home health company, and that's what you kind of expect.
Yeah.
And then Medicaid serves the same purpose, right?
Yeah.
Because you know that's a huge expense.
Yeah.
So the other part of this is, as you started to say, these corporations are trying to find the sweet spot, right? They love pushing the expenses for benefits, or for even, I would say, food's not a benefit. Food should be something you can buy with what you make at
neither
your job.
Neither is healthcare.
Well, but it is still considered a benefit.
It should be.
Then we're not going to argue the issue of whether it's a human right. In the menu of things corporations offer, it's considered a benefit.
I don't think it should be a corporate based.
I agree with you, but that's a whole nother.
We won't go there today.
So, what they're looking for is a sweet spot.
Right.
They love that they can pay less, because these other things are covered by taxpayer dollars, right? And remember that 50% of the United States population does not pay any federal taxes. Now, some of those people do pay state
sales
taxes.
Tax,
well, and sales taxes. There's other ways that revenue is gotten.
Yeah.
But they don't pay income taxes to the federal government.
Right.
So there's a lot of people who are not there's actually a very small number of people who contributed substantial amounts of money to the funding of the federal government. But the corporations want to be in that sweet spot, which is they can keep their wages down, right? Because that saves them money. And they want to put on the commons the cost of things that they're...
The taxpayers.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and it kind of explains, like, after, you know, 2021 and the worst of COVID was beginning, you know, it was over, almost immediately the front organizations for the corporations, you know, mostly the Chamber of Commerce and then for the realtors too, because they, you know, the eviction notice thing was suspended during COVID. Immediately, they got Congress to pass an act saying people got to go back to work. Because they got the Congress to reverse the extra money that, that federal government had given to states to pass out for unemployment insurance. So they want to keep their workers barely survivable on what they make, but then they're able to feel better about themselves because somebody else is paying for it. Now, which always makes me wonder, why then are these corporations against continuing to support Medicaid?
Well, I was wondering that too just now. I mean, I would think that they would be lining up to support maintaining SNAP at its current level. They would be in line with supporting the Democrats' proposal on Medicaid. I would think that they would be, and maybe they are. I don't know. I don't know where their lobbyists are lining up on that on those issues in Washington, D.C.
Well, I don't think they're on the side of further expenditures on this, and I think that's for two reasons. One is that because part of the package is that you get, you know, for their high-level executives, lower income tax rates, and for your corporation, lower corporate rates, even though the corporate, you know, the corporation tax in the United States is historically low.
Mm-hmm. Lower than it ever has been, too.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so I would guess that their calculation is that they benefit more by the corporate tax being lowered. So then there's no real reason. They don't have to push for Medicaid, you know, they're taking the whole package. This is what the administration is offering. They do better anyway because, you know, people, the corporation doesn't pay as much tax. Also, let's face it, you know, there's a book out about the people who inhabit the C-suites in, you know, Fortune 500 companies in the United States.
C-suites and, are the...
Yeah, the executives.
Okay, yeah.
The high-level executives.
Right.
And, you know, the estimate is between 10 and 15% of them would qualify for being sociopaths. You know, mostly narcissistic.
I think that's kind of low.
Mostly narcissistic sociopaths. So, you know, they look at their workers as the serfs. I mean, we know that because we have a whole government full of people like that.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think there's a lot of reasons why. But I agree with you. I've never totally understood why they don't want to fund Medicaid fully.
Well, maybe they're embarrassed to admit that it's helping to subsidize low wages.
People don't shop at Walmart because they care about how they treat their workforce.
Right.
People shop at Walmart because it's cheaper.
They see it as cheaper.
Well, how do you mean by that?
In some cases, it's not. There's been some great research done years ago by a professor from Iowa State University, Ken Stone, who found that a lot of that's mythology that that you can get the cheapest prices at these big box stores. They have some leaders that are cheaper, but when you start adding up the whole bill, when you've been to the store and bought whatever it is you want, you know, your bill's not any better than it
might
be elsewhere.
You know, how long ago did he do that?
It's been a while.
Because I think one of the things that's changed since that study was done is that the big box stores, Target, Walmart, you know, most notably, have huge grocery stores. In fact, Walmart's the biggest grocery store in the United States.
Bigger than Albertsons and Kroger's.
Correct,
and
exactly.
Yeah.
And so I think that changes the economics. Because even if some of the Chinese-made items in Walmart and Target, you know, are more expensive than we would think, they are quite, you know, competitive on food.
Yeah, but grocery stores, I mean, the margin the grocery stores, you know, get by on is tiny.
It's like 2%. It's like
2%. Actually, 2% is high.
Actually, grocery stores make the most money over money they get from the companies that sell product within their stores for positioning the product on the shelves. They make more money doing that than they do from
or if they have a cafe, that'll
right. You know, there's a lot of other ways to do it, but I was surprised to hear that the signage is so lucrative.
But this, I mean, here's back to a conversation we've had on this program before. why should these companies even exist? Why should they be able to, you know, dominate a market to the point where they force all competitors out through, you know, strong-arming their suppliers, through outsourcing production to places that pay low wages or that have poor environmental conditions or horrible working conditions? Why should these corporations even be allowed to do this? They should not be able to get away with this.
And your point is?
So,
that's capitalism.
No,
right?
It's not.
What is the point of capitalism, as
Mitt Romney called it. Yeah. Good old Mitt Romney. You know, it's capitalism only works if there's a strong commitment to antitrust laws, to preventing monopolies, to making sure that there's a level playing field, that someone who wants to be a small operator can still have a place at the table. And that doesn't exist now.
I don't disagree with you there. But it's very clear that people will talk a good game. But when it comes down to, you know, push comes to shove, people just want prices to be lower.
The consumer.
Right. The consumer wants, that is the main driver. It's the main driver in our politics now, right? You know, they want their prices to be lower.
Now, you mean the main reason people decide who to vote for at the polls?
Well, no. I'm just saying, when they say it's the economy, stupid, it's about two things, jobs and prices. Okay. And the way you keep prices down isn't your idealized Jeffersonian world, right?
Yeah, well,
it's to have mega corporations that can use their buying power and everything
then
else
you no
to
longer
force
have,
prices
then
down.
Then you no longer have democracy. You cannot have unbridled, you know, capitalism. There were no restrictions. No, it's like having a football game without having rules. It's fudging on what a first down is. Maybe it's 10 yards, maybe it's 11, maybe it's 9. You know, you have to have rules or it means nothing. And right now, the rules in, or if you have really bad rules, right now we have really, really bad rules in our economy that allow these giants to exist and allow them to basically make you know, they exist because of, again, SNAP benefits, Medicaid benefits, and of all the other things we've talked about them doing. You know, you take away all those advantages, you put in, again, fair rules, you know, a level playing field, and they're not going to dominate the market like they do now.
Well, you know, they've convinced people that regulations are bad, right? Because it increases the cost of production. It forces them to pay higher wages than they normally would. And, you know, the government has, when in the hands of those who did care about those things, has had a hard time, explaining to people they're not regulations, they're protections. Their protections about not being killed at your job. You know, it's like a friend of mine back in West Virginia said, you know what would be the best thing to do if you want to fix the coal mine safety issue? You make it so that the corporate headquarters has to be inside one of their coal mines. You'd see a lot better safety,
yeah,
right?
But other than that,
you have to coerce. And what is this government doing now? They're turning around and getting rid of every regulation they can.
Sure.
Typical. Now, that is not Trumpian. That's Republican. That's always been their argument, right?
And
regulations cost,
right.
Regulations cost too much money,
yeah.
Right?
Bad for business.
Yeah, it's bad for business.
Yeah.
You know, and then if you go out, let's say, and ask people, how much would you pay? And you ask people who say they believe in climate change, okay? How much would you be willing to pay on your electric bill if it was needed to mitigate climate change? You know, like maybe rebuild the grid or whatever. Hmm. Most people, once you get above $20, $25,
well,
it's all right.
Yeah, and
it's not worth it.
The good news there is that solar and wind and other forms of renewable energy are now cheaper than fossil fuels.
But people seeing their prices go up in spite of that because of demand that by crypto mines and others.
Yeah, and because of increased, continued subsidies for fossil fuels. There's no reason that oil, gas, and coal should be subsidized.
Well, no, I agree with that, but I think right now the dominant issue is what's the price of electricity. Well, number one, electricity, number two, gas.
Yeah.
You know, which of course, as we know from President Trump, is $2 a gallon everywhere in the United States. Under $2 a gallon.
Cheaper than it ever has been.
Cheaper than it ever has been, yeah. I mean, I grew up in a time when it was, 20 cents a gallon? Before the Arab oil embargo.
Right. Yeah, you did. You old thing.
Yep.
All right. Hey, I got to take a short break. This is Ed Fallon with Charles Goldman. When we come back, we're going to talk about food from a different angle. We're going to talk about ultra-processed foods. And yes, a real concern about that. Back in a minute here on the Fallon Forum.
Catholic Peace Ministry is an independent nonprofit guided by an ecumenical board representing many faith traditions. Founded in 1980, Catholic Peace Ministry focuses on nuclear disarmament and ending the wars between Israel and Hamas and Russia and Ukraine. CPM's overarching concern is the need to end the permanent war economy, which must be challenged if we are to achieve lasting peace and justice. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com.
At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrom's primary concern. Dr. Westrom and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village. Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. And thanks to our sponsors, including Story County Veterinary Clinic, where Dr. Kim Holding has been taking care of all manners of creatures, great and small, for over 30 years. Learn more at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Thanks also to Architecture by Synthesis. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. All right, Charles, so we're going to talk more about food. I know you're a big fan of ultra-processed foods.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're all big fans.
Oh, man, it's new information out about just how bad this stuff is. I mean, I don't know if we even need to, I mean, do people need to hear this anymore?
Well, no, we can just skip the segment.
We can just skip the segment, right? But, I mean, it's so bad. Good article in The Guardian last month and in other places as well. It's been linked to harm in every major organ system of the human body. And as such, you know, it's a threat to human health across the globe because it's not just Americans that have an obesity problem anymore.
That's true. And the changeover, you know, in diet that occurs before we see the same kind of harms in other places. You know, even in places like, you know, they're known as the blue zones, where, you know, people live well beyond the average life expectancy. Some of those areas are now converting over more toward the Western diet. And McDonald's is there and, you know, other kind of fast food places. And almost immediately you start seeing exactly the same thing you see here.
Yeah, the article in The Guardian says, quote, the sharp rise in UPF, ultra-processed foods, intake worldwide is being spurred by profit-driven corporations using a range of aggressive tactics to drive consumption, skewer scientific debate, and prevent regulation. I mean, it sounds like what the fossil fuel companies do, I don't know how many ways you got to say it, but big corporations do not care about us, whether they're AI or energy. Or food, they don't care about us or about our health or well-being. And now, you know, they're increasing their market share by dominating food consumption around the globe. Even as there is a rising interest in locally grown food and healthy food in this country, you know, they're finding the big corporations that make this crap are finding markets elsewhere. Doctor.
Well, now we're back to the Rousseauian peaceable kingdom times. We've moved back from Jefferson. Let me put it in some context for you. The estimate is that poor diet quality, and that includes the presence of ultra-processed foods, but there are other things in the United States that, you know, render our diet not a good one, leads to about 500,000 premature deaths annually in the United States.
Surprises that low.
During COVID, the estimate is that a healthier population that did not have the same diet-driven maladies, particularly obesity and diabetes and heart disease, would have had 60% fewer hospitalizations and deaths during the pandemic. Hmm. So that's a lot of people.
Whose research was that?
Not specific. I got rid of the references for this. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
That was actually from the Global Burden of Disease Study. It's clear that ultra-processed foods are a huge health problem. Now, the first question I think for most people is, what would you define ultra-processed food as?
Well, I don't have a definition in front of me.
You must have one in your mind.
Yeah, I do.
That's not grown on your urban farm.
Right. Well, any food, to admit it, processing food is fine. That means cooking. That means grinding.
I think you're making a good point because there was an article.
It means homogenizing.
There was an article in Nature making that point, which is a very reputable, pure science, basic science magazine, that there are elements of processing that in fact do
improve the quality.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, having bread not go stale 3 days after
I would disagree on that one because you can eat a loaf of bread in a day.
Okay, but if you're eating a loaf of bread in a day, now you have
not one person.
You've got another caloric problem.
Not one person. No, share it with friends.
There are
and
elements
family,
of processing.
Right? Or you make a smaller loaf. Right.
There are elements of processing that are either beneficial, and certainly there's a huge benefit to not having spoilage.
The key word here is ultra. When you start adding all these chemicals,
tell me what is.
You adding stuff that is not part of nature, that doesn't belong there in the first place. You instead of food being made in a garden or a granary or a dairy, it's being made in a laboratory, and that's
What about faux meat?
I am totally against faux meat.
Why?
Well, it's not even meat, first of all.
Because it's we're not going to have that argument because they went to court over that. I understand that, but.
No, it's not a natural product. Faux meat?
Yeah. It's a plant product.
It's a highly processed.
It is a highly processed.
Ultra processed plant
interestingly,
product.
Interestingly, although if you look at the items that are in faux meat, and soon there's going to be lab meat where they just grow it, from a single meat cell.
Right. Beautiful. I can hardly wait to slice into that burger. God. Bring me the ketchup and mustard, please.
Even diets that use faux meat instead of meat actually show health benefits. And it doesn't go along with
compared
the ingredients.
To what?
Compared to eating a diet in which you eat red meat.
No, I think red meat just gets a bad rap.
The only red meat that might possibly be healthy for you is red meat from grass-fed. Because then the fat profile is much closer to fish, not grain-fed, hormonal.
I agree with that. I think grass-fed cattle cattle are designed to eat grass. They're not designed to eat corn.
That's correct.
If you want to finish it off with some corn, I get that. But to me, grass-fed cattle are definitely a superior, way to raise them. And also the flavor.
Even with grass-fed, there's a limit as to how much meat we should be eating.
It's not an
open-ended proposition.
Yeah, we don't. Meat is a side dish for us.
Yeah.
I do think it's a problem when it's
main
item.
Let's go back to ultra-processed. The definition you're using of ultra-processed is...
Basically made in a laboratory.
It's like, I'll know it when I see it.
Yeah, right. So it's basically laboratory, chemicals, long list of ingredients, most of which you can't pronounce.
Right, like Michael Pollan said, the Berkeley professor who's written a number of books about the food supply.
Right.
Anything that's more than five ingredients is not food. It's just a chemical concoction.
Exactly.
Interestingly, the research definition, which is used very widely, is a classification known as NOVA. And grade four ultra processing is defined very simply. It contains ingredients you don't find in your kitchen at home.
Yeah. Or in your garden.
You don't see emulsifiers. Yeah. You don't see, other additives.
Monosodium glutamate.
Which also, of course...
Red dye number four.
Here's an interesting thing. Which is the ultra-processed item here? Regular soda, especially if it's Trump Coke with the cane sugar in it, or diet soda?
Any soda.
Okay.
None of that stuff is good for you. It's all bad for you.
Okay. Well, for various
reasons.
Show
me the tree that a bottle of Coke grows on.
Okay, but the one that's actually more ultra-processed is the one that uses artificial sweetener, right? And
sure,
actually,
yeah.
It's been shown that artificial sweetener, in many ways, is no better than drinking, you know, regular sugar. So that's the point, which is that that's kind of an accepted scientific classification,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I think that's very helpful to people. They don't, you know, they don't have to go through, you know, parsing every ingredient list. They know when they look at an ingredient list that's 25 things long, there's got to be something in there, multiple things, that they don't find in their kitchen.
Right, and that they probably shouldn't be eating.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, look at, like, ice cream. Cheap ice creams use what? Carrageenan.
Yeah.
Right? To keep the fat in solution.
That's why you should stick with Ben and Jerry's and Haagen-Dazs.
Oh, right. You know, but you see, people, first of all, consumers don't like when you don't emulsify fat in their food, right? They don't like, for instance, buying peanut butter. That
because they've gotten used to it.
I understand that, but that's exactly the point.
Get used to eating better, and you'll crave better, and you won't want to
eat
this
crap. Okay, so how do you get the fat back in the peanut butter after it's all coalesced on the top of the...
You stir it with a fork. Or a knife.
But by that time, what's below it has become rock hard, and you need like...
Well, not if you do it right. You're not very good at this stuff, are you? I'll give you a demonstration someday on how to stir a jar of peanut butter.
Right, but people don't like... The other thing is... And this is one place I agree with you in your paranoia about corporations.
My justifiable paranoia about corporations.
It's absolutely true that this is a conscious act to change food to make it more attractive. In fact, there was a suit, I believe, back in the 90s in which they were able to get emails or whatever the primitive form of email was. Maybe like people,
a piece of paper a letter
with words on them. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. How novel! How
exactly.
Quaint.
And basically, it was Kraft, which is the biggest ultra processed food company in the world,
and the owner of the Patriots,
right? And Philip Morris, because they were under the same umbrella as a corporation, and they were passing information back and forth. They were doing early functional MRI, so it wasn't the 90s, it was a little further along.
It was all about creating addiction.
It was about creating addiction because the mechanism of addiction to cigarettes can be manipulated in the same way you can make foods that addict people to food. Because what the food that is constructed, it's not really ultra-processed, it's constructed food. And
ultra-processed.
Right, it's constructed to override your normal satiety mechanisms your satiety mechanism that tells you I've eaten enough.
I'm full, right. Sure. Yep.
Right. So I'll stop, right? It also transfers a lot of calories to liquids, and liquids run through your stomach
like Coke. Yeah.
Or fruit juice.
Sure.
Fruit juice is no more healthy than Coke.
I wouldn't go that far, but I agree that it's not...
If you take the fiber out, it's no more healthy than Coke.
No, it's not the best way to eat a piece of fruit.
Right. And then, of course, the high fructose corn syrup, which is not biochemically doing anything different to the body. What it's doing is it's accustoming you to wanting things way sweeter, right? Now, interestingly, what's another thing that has a lot of fructose in it, which you have here on your natural homestead?
Honey.
Honey. Yeah. Honey is fructose.
And it's good for you.
Right. And it's good for you because there's other things in honey. Fiber, antioxidants. So honey's value is more in the other things that are in it. And also it's not as concentrated in terms of the milligrams. You can't eat enough honey to eat the milligrams you can get of sugar out of a bottle of, you know, Fanta or something. You know, so it's to acclimate you to that. Also, interestingly, what these constructed foods do is they offer things that will make you... You know, the way your brain interprets taste is it's very segmented. There's like sweet, there's salt, then there's umami, whatever that is. You know, I've never been exactly sure. I can't explain what umami is because I...
Umami.
Yeah.
I've never heard of the word.
Yeah.
If I never heard of the word, I'm not going to eat it.
Anyway.
Oh, meat?
Well,
umami
means
meat? Protein?
It would be, but it's also a taste. It's something else. But
never
the point is that if you stimulate all of them at once... You actually override, again, that
so,
helps to ride, so, override
so
the satiety.
So people eat more than they should and they become obese.
Correct. Yeah. And that's why, especially the favorite, just puts salt and sugars together.
Why does, I think a functional government, a government that actually cares about people, would not allow this to happen. And, you know, as we can say all kinds of bad things about Robert F. Kennedy Jr., but this is the one place in which I think he's making a lot of sense, is taking on the ultra-processed food industry. And, ultimately, to me, there's got to be regulations that prevent this sort of, you know, manipulation of human desire to the detriment of the entire, of the individual, certainly, but of all of society. I just said something nice about RFK, and you look like you're in a
deer in
headlights.
I agree with what he's saying. I mean, I think absolutely. It's very Machiavellian what these companies are doing.
Yeah.
Right.
And they should not be allowed to do it.
Yeah, but do you ever want to win an election again? It's just not going to happen. What? Because
more and more people are caring about this. More and more people understand the importance of natural foods.
Your circle of people.
No, there's a lot of people on the political right.
That's true.
Who get this.
Yeah.
It's not a partisan issue.
It isn't a partisan issue, huge amount of money that flows in to support continuing this system.
But even people who consume poor quality food understand that it's not the best thing in the world. They understand that it's a problem.
Yes.
And so I think the time to do something about it is now. Go RFK.
With RFK is that you get the whole package. You don't just get, let's have better food.
Right, right.
You also get, like, let's, you know, get rid of vaccinations that, you know, the natural experiment of hepatitis B vaccination has already been done. The incidence of hepatitis leading ultimately to liver failure and cirrhosis and liver cancer, you know, starting in your pediatric age group, went down 90%, 90%+ when they started giving babies the injection.
That's another conversation.
Well, that just shows you.
In the meantime,
RFK has no idea what risk and benefit
is. In the meantime,
is.
Don't eat ultra processed foods.
It's hard to eat in this country if you don't. But
we do it.
Yep,
you can do it
best.
Too.
You should try your best. That's correct.
Right. Hey, thanks, Charles. Charles Goldman with me on the program here, folks. I'm going to sign off after this break. Kathy Burns is going to come back and discuss the winter soup pot. Back in a minute on the Fallon Forum. Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design-build services for high-performance, low-maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766. Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Kathy Burns with you. Thanks to psychiatrist Dr. David Drake. If you live in Iowa, Dr. Drake can help through the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling, offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. Contact DavidDrakeFamilyPsychiatry.com. As we are now, in late December, in the profoundest time of winter, and what many view as the holiday season, for our farm and food segment today, I'm offering a brief reading from an old treasured book. Its title and subtitle are quite extensive. The Wonderful World of Cooking, From Hearty to Epicurean, All Told as the Seasons Pass in a House on a Country Hill. The author, Edward Harris Heth. It was published by Simon & Schuster in 1956. The copy I'm reading from was given to Rosalie Riglin, accomplished writer and food editor, during the 1940s through the 1970s or so. She was also the aunt of my first husband and a great-grandmother figure to our three children. Rose's book was signed affectionately by Dorothy Kinnett, a well-known food consultant from California with whom Rose must have worked from time to time. Ms. Canet adds a traditional Scottish blessing. For Roz, that was Rose's name in the publishing world, long may your loom rake, or long may your chimney smoke. This is part four of the book called Winter Reward, chapter one, The Winter Soup Pot. Winter means blocked roads, the fear that the volunteer fire department can't reach you if needed, cars that won't start. Often after a storm, the snowplow does not arrive for 3 or 4 days. Trees crack from the freezing cold in the dead of night. The lights from neighbors' farms seem twice as far away. The rare friends who come to visit have a lust for driving into the nearest snowdrift. You shovel your life away, and then the friend dug out cheerfully waves that he'll see you in spring. On a winter walk, Mrs. Brubaker's house looks so untenanted, even in ill repair now, as to make me think she will never return. These are days of isolation and boredom, until I remember the companionship of a soup pot. From Ruth Hummock, I first learned of the dignity of the soup pot. She and it are inseparable all winter long. A pot is always on active duty at the rear of her stove, and into it go many unlikely things. Since her family is large and are sturdy eaters of meat, there are always big bones left from roasts or boiled dinners. Into the pot. Scraps of meat, a leftover potato or turnip, a spoonful of stewed tomatoes. Into the pot. A cupful of leftover sauerkraut, potato water, and chicken or duck carcass divested of every shred of flesh, a bowl of unwanted gravy, a neglected prune, a chunk of celery half chewed by one of the children. Ruth does cut off the tooth marks. All go into the ever-simmering pot to make a surprisingly flavorful and varied broth. When supper time comes, the broth is strained, yesterday's bones discarded, and whatever amount is needed, ladled into another kettle to become the evening's soup. Noodles or dumplings or tomato or potato or vegetable, the latter, of course, being least popular, oppressively loaded as it is with vitamins. Or nothing more than a store-bought can of boiled onions is added, which makes a delicious soup, though I also add a good supply of parsley, washed, dried, and then fried crisp in butter, and a jigger of sherry, and a slice of lemon. And into the pot of remaining broth goes more water, a leftover veal bone from noon dinner, a chicken wing, plus a shin bone or piece of rump from the fall butchering to replenish the magic cauldron for tomorrow. There is always steam on Ruth's kitchen windows. A Frenchman thinks as highly of his soup pot as he does his wife or his mistress, and this is a custom Ruth has inherited from a maternal French-Canadian grandmother. Sometimes, Ruth grins, a Frenchman's soup pot is as old as his marriage. Whether or not one feels uneasy at the occasional antiquity of Ruth's soups, it is always pleasant to walk into her kitchen on a cloudy, bitter day. The warmth and fragrance are compelling. The omnipresent and innumerable children dip in for a ladleful whenever they are hungry. It is stabilizing to always have a kettle of soup on hand. I have adopted this custom without letting my broth become as mellow as Ruth's. After 3 or 4 days of haphazardly tossing in whatever might catch my eye, and then savoring the resulting, unpredictable but always pleasing broth, the dregs are tossed out, the pot scrubbed, and a fresh soup begun. A thick, velvety chicken and onion soup, or a filling lentil and ham soup, or the remarkable dill pickle soup. But at least there is always a pot of soup around, purring like a household pet and obliging as an old friend. Let it rage outside. The soup only grows thicker and better. Whatever may be in the pot, it is always a hearty winter soup, supper unto itself. For a Saturday night supper party, a loaf of hot, buttered, crusty bread and a salad are added. The big, steaming, ironstone tureen supplies all the rest. So that's our show for today. Thanks to our production team of Sherry Herdina, Forrest Detterman, Charles Goldman, Ed Fallon, and me, Kathy Burns. Thanks also to our local small business partners, Gateway Market and Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Western Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, Architecture by Synthesis, and real estate agent Joe Henry. Thanks also to our nonprofit partners, Catholic Peace Ministry, Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Bold Iowa, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, and Climate March. Finally, thanks to the Des Moines Irish Session for providing our bumper music. We'll be back next week with another hour of cutting-edge talk radio.
Bless the man who wears this cloth. May he wounded never be from the bitter cold and frost. May this cloth protect